Hi, my name is Cecilia Pounin, and welcome to this episode of Brave New Women. All around the world, there are amazing, ordinary women doing extraordinary things. Brave New Women is about giving those women a platform and a voice, and it's about changing the way that women are perceived. And it's a way of inspiring all of us to do the things that we've always wanted to do. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be speaking to Natalia Rossi. Natalia is the country director at the Wildlife Conservation Society in Cuba. And she is a herpetologist and has a PhD from Columbia University and in the American crocodile. So I'm talking to Natalia today about her work with crocodiles in Cuba, also what it's been like as a woman working in conservation and particularly on crocodiles. The third thing we're going to cover is a new marine protected area, which has just been created in Cuba, which has been a fabulous success. So welcome, Natalia.
Happy to be here. It's very nice to be here with you all.
And Natalia, the first question I had is, what is a herpetologist?
Yeah, basically, we studied reptiles, which encompass a large group of species, lizards, geckos, also crocodiles, sea turtles, tortoises. So we studied that group of animals that are sort of put together before molecular genetics determined that some of these groups were not so closely related, but we still, because of some, you know, characteristics from the outside of these animals, that we kept them there. So we studied reptiles. We like these types of animals.
And where does your interest in reptiles come from?
Well, I guess I was interested from a young age in any animal, especially more than plants. And then when I was doing my bachelor's, I got completely obsessed and in love with sea turtles. And before that, I liked reptiles like snakes and lizards but it was really when I jumped into sea turtle conservation that I fell completely for that field. And later on, I moved into crocodiles and it was an extremely rewarding experience to work with crocodiles. So it's an interesting group of animals, ancient, and they have lots of survival skills that no other group has. Mainly, they can spend a lot of time without eating, not like us or birds, for instance. And they have been in the planet for thousands and thousands of years. So there is something to say about the adaptability and their capacity to be resilient to changes in the planet.
Have crocodiles changed much over those thousands of years, or are they exactly as they were?
They've changed. They were many more species before some of the mass extinctions that went through in our planet through history. Now we have 23, 24 species. Before, there were more species and they were much larger also. Some of the species were much larger, but they kept, you know, their body shape, their feeding habits, their adaptability, their nesting behavior. So lots of them is very conserved. They survived dinosaurs extinction, but there were many more species before, also when the planet was looking different, much warmer. And I guess less threatening due to human activity. Mm.
And can you just give me a little bit of your background? So where do you come from?
Yes, I'm originally from Argentina in South America, in the south of the Americas, and I studied there biology in the University of Buenos Aires. My family also love nature. One of my grandpas at some point was a ranger, and then my mom was into arts, and I also had that that background. And then I went on to work in Mexico in the Pacific of Mexico to work on sea turtle conservation after I graduated. And from there, I started my journey getting a scholarship to go to Columbia University to do a master's in conservation biology, where I continue my work with the conservation of loggerhead sea turtles in Baja California Sur, Mexico. And then I joined the Wildlife Conservation Society for a while. And then I went back on a PhD on working on crocodiles in Cuba. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a long story short, many, many years of studying and being in the field. So it has been a really cool adventure.
It sounds fantastic. Before we get into the crocodiles, I'd actually be interested just to hear a little bit about your work with the sea turtles in Mexico.
Yeah, you know, the sea turtle community is unusual because it's very it's relatively small, very tight community where everyone knows each other. So I have colleagues working in sea turtles in Argentina and Uruguay, and these are feeding grounds for green turtles. Some loggerheads also go there. And I wanted to get training and I wanted to experience working abroad as well. And some of my colleagues recommended me this project in Baja California Sur in fishing communities to work with a team of researchers, Mexican and American researchers, trying to reduce the bycatch, the incidental capture in fishing nets of loggerhead sea turtles. This area in the Pacific of Baja California is a hotspot for loggerheads. They spend there feeding about 30 years or plus, and then they travel all the way to Japan to reproduce. So it's one of the longest migrations for loggerheads. So I decided to just get my backpack, and I was lucky to be accepted as a volunteer in the project. And it was a life-changing experience because I really understood conservation. We were living in a fishing communities, a group of biologists, and we were working in, let's say, all aspects of conservation, from studying the turtles and their movements, putting satellite tags on them, understanding mortality, because many of them will be washed off in the coast. Some of that could be natural mortality. Some of that could be because they were entangled in fishing nets accidentally and then just dropped and they would just wash off. I was working with fishers. Basically, we were trying to deploy alternative fishing nets to see if bycatch would be reduced. So my daily work was going, you know, 8-10 hours a day on fishing boats with fishers, one or two, and record everything these alternative nets would caught to see productivity, what they would get as fish, their livelihood would be the same or different, as well as incidental captures of sea turtles. So it was an incredible experience. And then there was all other team working on community engagement and sea turtle festivals. I was drawn to this entire field of conservation where you not only do just the biology work of looking, you know, conducting a assessment, oh, what's the cause of death of this turtle, or let's put a satellite tag on that turtle, but working with the fishers, understanding their lives, their connection with turtles, understanding the community, and also how turtles could survive in this sort of conflict, because the fishers were not meaning to fish them, but they were getting entangled. So we were all working together to try to give value to the sea turtles in the community. They already had, but plus. And then also to find solutions to reduce the fishing. So it was incredible. I met mentors there, and that sort of took me to my master's at Columbia. I actually never dreamed of applying to such scholarship, and I was encouraged, and I say, okay, why not? Mm. And then I was fortunate to pass all my interviews and to be offered a place at Columbia in their master's in the ecology and environmental biology program. Yes.
Fantastic. Just going back to the experience in Mexico, it sounds like it was a very complete experience and very much integrated in the community and working out how to find solutions that worked both for the turtles and for the fishermen and for the local people.
Definitely. And lessons that I learned there stood with me for long, even to the creation of this marine protected area in Cuba, this sort of conservation in action, where you are not only a biologist, you know, isolated in your fascination for certain animals, but you understand the problems on the ground, and then you really work with people close together to find solutions. And that for me was it. It's like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Yeah.
And did you find solutions for the sea turtles?
Yeah, you know, some nets work, some didn't. So at the end of the day, what ended up working better were temporary closures for certain areas to fish. So that was sort of the main solution, increasing protected area coverage and just fishing more smartly to you know, protect the income and the livelihood of fishers while fishing responsibly to have fish for the future and to help the turtles survive. So I think it took a long time, but yes, luckily due to all the work, collective work, the solutions were found. And it's not always the case, but that's what we all try always to achieve.
I really love that. That such a the word that's coming to me is integrative way of dealing with conservation, that it's taking into account the whole ecosystem and the people, what everybody needs, trying to find solutions that work for everybody.
Yeah, I think it's about compromise as well, because we all share the planet and we all want to live a decent life. But it would be amazed that many times there are solutions that benefit, and most of the time there are solutions that benefit the long-term survival of communities and the species, because many practices that are unsustainable, that they will result in not only no turtles there, but no fish. So the idea is to fish smartly, to fish responsibly, and to try to coexist and take, but not take everything. So a lot of really smart fisheries biologists working also in there, anthropologists, conservationists. So it was definitely a life-changing experience.
So you went to Columbia University to do a master's? And then
yes, it was incredible. I mean, New York City, I was born in a city, but New York City is beyond, you know, any other city in the world. It was shocking at the beginning. Everything, the smells, the size of my room, tiny, but immediately met a wonderful community of other students from across the United States, from New York, and from all over Latin America, Asia, so Africa as well. So it's definitely a place where you can learn so much from others. And Columbia gave me that platform. Is also very well integrated with other programs across the campus, where you can go to talks on, you know, and sustainability and economics and green economy. And you cross the street and there is the Earth Institute, and you can have an internship. So for me, it was okay. I'm gonna do all I can, because this is really incredible. The opportunity was great. Thanks to Fulbright scholarship and Columbia, that gave me a spot. So I got a really eye-opener. Back then in my university in Buenos Aires, we were really into research. Conservation was more incipient there. And when I went to Columbia, I was connected with projects of the Wildlife Conservation Society, with the American Museum of Natural History, and lots of people doing conservation. So it was a dream being there, learning from other conservationists, from professors and mentors, and was trying to take it all in. My English was not great back then, but I was, you know, doing my best to catch up. And New York was really good to me. The community where I was living and neighbors and everyone was welcoming.
And so how did you get to Cuba?
Yes, I got to Cuba because after I graduated in my master's, I actually was trying to get into a PhD continuing in turtles, but I didn't get, PhDs, you need to get a job offer, a scholarship, and it was not the best time. So I say, okay, I will work instead. I had the opportunity to work for a year. So I got an opportunity to work in the Latin American Caribbean program and the Wildlife Conservation Society, where I met one of my mentors, Dr. Avesita Chikchon. She was back then the director of the program. And I work in all sorts of program support from New York, revising proposals, supporting logistics, and in all Latin America and the Caribbean. But I got especially connected with another herpetologist, a world-class crocodile biologist called John Tjørbjørnarson. We would call him John T. And between him and Avesita, we started to discuss, because they knew I wanted to go back to studying, to discuss the opportunity to join him in some of his crocodile projects, which was a bit scary for me, because, of course, from turtles to crocodiles, there is a danger level that changes, but on the other hand, fascinating. And I was all up for it. And so they actually support my work, the opportunity to join, extremely supportive mentors. And the sad thing was that John unfortunately passed away from malaria just when I was starting my PhD. So it was devastating for everyone, because he was a true hero for conservation of crocodiles, really establishing deep connections at all levels in the field and being a champion for these species. And then all of a sudden, yeah, I was alone and trying to connect with a new country, which I have not really known the community there working in conservation. So slowly but slowly, I started with the support of other mentors, and I got an opportunity to be mentored by Josh Ginsberg, which was also back then working in WCS. He took me in, and Dr. George Amato from the American Museum of Natural History. So with their support, and then going to Cuba and finding my way. And then,
so how many people were working for the Wildlife Conservation Society in Cuba at that stage?
So at that stage, it was actually a program that was unusual in the sense that we, due to the bilateral politics between United States and Cuba, there was no office there. So it was actually, at the moment, it was John T. and there was another great researcher, Peter Feinsinger, working there. So it was a small group of maybe, and a shark biologist as well. Rachel Graham. So it was three main researchers working mainly connecting with the Cuban researchers and academics and conservationists. So it was a tiny effort.
Were they in Cuba?
They were going back and forth. Yeah. Yeah. That's how sort of we have worked there, in collaboration with local partners and spending some time in Cuba and some time, whatever every one of them lived, being, Latin America or United States. So.
And what were your first experiences with the crocodiles?
Yes. So it was definitely interesting. I went for the first time going to the field, the sort of the fathers of crocodile conservation in Cuba were a group of three biologists, and they were already around in their 50s. So men, so I was a bit intimidated. And the project I joined in was in Eastern Cuba. So in Cuba, transport is actually a challenge, especially on a student budget. So we had to go drive with a field assistant and colleague from Havana to this tiny village called Jobabo. About in 2 days we would drive, because the roads were not so good. So then from there, we had to take a tractor about 4 hours to the sort of the pier and then cross a mud flow. And then we took a boat and then we reached this beautiful, beautiful, it's like a small bay area where a river meets the Caribbean Sea in the wildlife refuge, Monte Cabanyuan. And there was paradise. I quickly learned that mosquitoes and crocodiles love each other, so they mosquitoes were not so pleasant. But we were basically very remote and in an area where, the quantity and the quality of mangroves was stunning. It just was like being in, before people populated that area. It was completely wild, you know, with Cuban iguanas in the trees and all sorts of shorebirds and, of course, many, many crocodiles. For me, from the sea turtle world, I see the ocean and I swim. I go in. And in this case, I said, yeah, of course I'm going to swim. So it took a few days of convincing that I could, when we came back from work, because work was basically visiting nesting sites of crocodiles, lagoons. But there was some moments where we have to travel in a small boat. And so I say, okay, I get a rope and you just take me and I go on the back. It was really, really hot and humid. So for me, not swimming was not an option. And everyone was, are you crazy, Natalia? This place is, 20,000 crocodiles around. And this species, the American crocodile, as they grow, they can tolerate salinity more and more. So they go further. And, I was not, afraid. So I usually went back in the back of the boat, just swimming like a bait. And fortunately, nothing ever happened. But I met this wonderful mentor there. He unfortunately passed away from COVID. It's really sad, the story. But last year, but he had a son and a daughter. And the son didn't have interest in sort of following his footsteps, but the daughter did. So he was already super open-minded about having another woman on board. And he treated me like a sister, like a daughter. And we could, have endless conversations about crocodiles conservation. And the team there is, five people, wonderful. Everyone could do everything. They could, wrestle a crocodile or cook an amazing meal or, fix a fishing net. So it was like being home every time I then went there. And every, when you are so deep into nature, every day is an adventure, because if it's not a thunderstorm that you're afraid is going to get you, then you see something incredible happening with bears or crocodiles that is never the same. It's always changing. And it wasn't hard being a woman, because I was welcomed like Natalia. It didn't matter. I know it's a field that is male testosterone driven, male dominated. So it was different in that sense from the sea turtles, that there are some very strong, researchers and students that, you need to prove yourself and you need to show that you are tough, and then you can grab a crocodile and do this or do that. But I was fortunate to jump in a project and an environment that was respectful and it was completely welcoming, and we were just into crocodiles. Nothing else mattered. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what were the issues about the crocodiles? What are threatening them? What's their status at the moment?
So in Cuba, the American crocodile is listed as vulnerable in the IUCN Red List of Endangered Species. And Cuba has the largest population of the species. They occur from the southern tip of Florida to Venezuela, and then from northern Mexico in the Pacific to Ecuador. So they are pretty widespread. They are very adaptable, and they can, as I mentioned, live in rivers or live in brackish areas. In Cuba, in this case, this population was very healthy. It's the largest nesting population in the entire range. We would collect, we would monitor about 300, sometimes 400 nests only in these small, in some small nesting sites. And for these species, it was mainly the increased severity of hurricanes that as they have evolved with these events. Usually they have been beneficial because they open up nesting sites. Imagine this landscape as a very, very dense mangrove area where patches of sand are limited and they are not everywhere. So they need that to build, to dig and to make nests.
So they need hurricanes, did you say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So in this case, if hurricanes occur too frequently, then there is no time to shape the landscape as for them to nest and to have a good reproductive season. Meaning that if waves are too high, the nest can be flooded and you could lose an entire nesting season for that. So as much as hurricanes have supported the opening of these nesting sites, the severity and the frequency being aumenting, then it can also, you know, trigger this problem of flooding nests and disrupting the nesting grounds. In this area in Cuba, they are doing well. So we wanted to study them and protect this sort of treasure population. In other places of the range, the main threat has been human development. Their life cycle needs the mangroves to feed in, you know, shrimp and fish when they are smaller, hiding the mangroves from other crocodiles because sometimes they eat each other. And then you need the nesting site, the places where they can dig their nests or other species they make, like little mound nests. But in Cuba, that didn't happen at a mass scale, coastal development and clearance of mangroves and erosion of beaches. So they are doing well, but climate change driven events and some illegal hunting does happen. But if you imagine a place like Cancun or areas that have been heavily modified, then the American crocodiles in those areas are not doing so well. Mm. So Florida is mainly the drainage of the Everglades and the push of these species more and more towards the coast. And of course, the coastal development. So this is sort of a population that is key to potentially replenish other populations, and as a source population of nation, and also the most abundant population in the entire range.
Mm-hmm. And what would happen if the crocodiles disappeared?
Well, it would be hard for mangroves because in these types of ecosystems, crocodiles are top predators, so they are regulating the food change top down, meaning that they eat a certain fish. So other species down the food chain can have healthy numbers. So whenever you remove top predators, and we see it with sharks, they can occur, you know, imbalances in the ecosystems, and some species can go crazy, and that has a whole effect even in the availability of certain fish that we eat. But also because these animals are big, massive, and their life cycle occurs between the mangroves and the coastlines, as they pass through, they build these canals, and these canals create water bodies and connect areas with less salt, with more salt and fresh water. So they really have an engineering role in the mangroves. And if that doesn't happen, then it will be harder for mangroves to sort of disperse and populate other areas. So it will be detrimental for the mangroves and of course for regulating down the food chain. So it wouldn't be good for for these types of ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the marine park or the marine protected area.
Yeah, so after I graduated for my PhD, I joined WCS to work in Cuba in all sorts of conservation projects involving other species as well. And as you know, one of the biggest targets of the last decade and this decade coming is to increase protection of marine areas. And in Cuba, they have done a good job having a pretty good network of protected areas, marine and terrestrial. But there are still some gaps, like in any other place. And so there was this particular area we got funding to work on the creation of a new marine protected area and support our Cuban colleagues to do that. And this area was a gap in the northwestern part of Cuba between to connect other MPAs, marine protected areas that were further east or further west. And the interesting thing about this area is this is one of the first described grouper and snapper spawning site. These areas where you have a large reproduction of fish and where the larva out of fish travels then through the currents and disperse these larva to many other places. And this area in the northwest of Cuba connects with the southern United States, with Bahamas. So the models that have been drawn for dispersal of corals and fish, several species of snappers and groupers, they are standing in the sense of you see in color how these spots is very important for the distribution and for the replenishment of these species. So we identified, and it was long identified in Cuba, this area as one important area to establish, but then the work to put it into protection was not complete. And that's where we started to work with the local NGO and local partners to establish this area. And, you know, how do you create a protected area from scratch? There are many ways to achieve that, but usually there are some steps that everyone follows, which is to understand the biodiversity values of this area, why this area needs to be protected, to understand the social ecological context, to see what are the conflicts, what are the human uses, and to go through a process of what we call marine spatial planning, where you work together to try to zone and to say, how are we going to all together live in this area and protect this area without significantly losing opportunities for livelihoods or it depends if you protect an area that is completely unpopulated or an area that has humans living there. So we went through that process and in this area because it was for a long time heavily fished because there were fishing regulations, but no specific protection or non-take zones. Then the main allies from the get-go were fishers because they could see through time how some of the landings and their catch has been reduced or the size of the fish. It was a really, I would put on the easier side because the fishers were on board from the beginning in doing this together and trying to say, well, we want to have a replenishment area where we can secure the reproduction area. So then we can get fish in the buffer zones or next to the buffer zones of the marine protected area and give a bit of time for these species to come back in huge numbers as before. So that in terms of the community engagement and working together process was incredibly inspiring to see. On the other hand, you know, the biology is going crazy trying to identify every species and every value with the botanists and the biologists. And And this area is also one of the first sort of landing sites for North American birds and migratory birds. So also there are several species of sea turtles, some nesting, many of them transiting as feeding areas, and then Caribbean manatees, sharks and rays and corals. So the description of all the biodiversity values, then to understand the uses and to work together with fishers, and also to try to think of how this area, if it's going to be a marine protected area, how it can sustain itself in terms of financial sustainability, what tools, what ideas are there, and also how it can uplift the communities that live there in creating opportunities for other livelihoods that might be entangled to visitors coming and to bird watching activities, to sports fishing, catch and release activities, diving. So that requires a lot of work thinking together also what opportunities can be there, what training is needed, in what time we can achieve that. So we not only just declare a protected area, but you have a plan to make it work.
And do you work heavily with the Cuban government or Cuban local councils? Or?
Yeah, the work is basically done by local actors. We are facilitators in the process, and that means the agencies, the environmental agencies that eventually manage the protected areas, and we work with them for our environmental projects. As well as the National Center of Protected Areas and research institutes like the Marine Research Institute and Fisheries Institute. So Cuba has an incredible wealth of researchers, experts, and institutions that can support when you want to achieve something like this, that can support the research side. It's a very rich country in human resources. So that is one of the advantages of working there in conservation, is the main advantage is the quality and the amount of passionate conservationists and researchers and people working in the environmental field. So we were all together.
Mm-hmm. And is the marine park very beautiful?
Ooh, it is stunning. You should visit. Mm-hmm. Basically, this province is called Pinar del Río, and Cuba is towards the west. And you have a World Heritage Site called Parque Nacional Viñales, which is in the middle of the between the coasts, and has stunning I don't know the name in English, mogotes, like are these sort of rocky
outcrops.
Outcrops. Mm-hmm. And then from there you drive a few hours and you're in the coast. And then you can find this place. It has an incredible amounts of keys. You can reach some of these keys on roads, built like almost like you're driving in the water, but you can also reach them on boats. And it's sort of the paradise beach that you imagine when you think of the Caribbean. Sorry, this is in the northern side of the island, but it's stunning. It's, you know, snorkeling or diving there is not a challenge. So it's usually, I mean, you can have current, but the view is amazing, and the amount of mangroves and seagrasses, and it's just a beautiful place.
Mm.
So I'm sure people will discover it as they travel through Cuba and support the protected area.
Fantastic. Natalia, I just wanted to go back to when you're working with the crocodiles, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis? So you get up in the morning and then?
Yeah, so you don't have to wake up so early like people studying birds. So you wake up like around 7, and then you have usually a very good breakfast, because Then you go on working until like about 3 p.m. So we usually have like a fish soup and, you know, bread, like a full meal at 7. At the beginning, you might think, oh my God, this is too much. And then you eat it. And then usually in the mornings, we go on a boat and we survey different nesting sites. In the nesting season, you can locate the nest because they have like a specific shape. You see like a little mound of sand. And then when crocodiles are about to hatch, you just put your foot in the sand and you make like a noise. And crocodiles are very vocal. And when they are about to hatch, so they start making noises because they associate us, you know, popping in as potentially the mother that is going to be digging them out. So so we usually count the nests, and some of these nests we unbury, and we then some of the crocodiles hatch from the egg, which is a spectacle itself to see how they are all crawl and they use a tooth to, you know, break the egg. And they become very frenzy. So that's when we measure them. We take a little skin sample for genetic analysis, and then we release them in the water nearby. But not for all the nests, but some of the nests that we need to monitor. And there we can see, you know, the survival rates, the hatching success, and other metrics that are related to the health of that population. So that usually is until 3 p.m. and then we go back, we have like lunch and in the meantime, you know, as you walk through the mangroves, all other sorts of things can happen, like finding a nest of a particular bird species or these endemic mammals called jutias that live in the trees or iguanas. And then we take advantage and then we monitor them as well. So it's always fun to go in the days. It's hot. But Cubans love their coffee, especially my former mentor. So we are drinking coffee with sugar through and having fun and just doing the work. And then we go back. I usually swim in the meantime. And then we have a big meal, huge, and take a break. And a few hours later, we go back to conduct night spotlight counts of adult crocodiles. So basically, their eyes shine when you use a spotlight, and we do census of crocodiles in the night. And it's intimidating because you go on a tiny boat and all of a sudden you start, you know, using your light and you see hundreds, you are surrounded. So,
oh my goodness me.
Yeah. And sometimes at night you can do night captures with nets to get bigger animals. But we usually did day captures to also sample animals. And that, I think, has been the most adrenaline thing done, because you basically, you know, in Cuba, you don't have, you know, all the resources to do this. So the team is fantastic. They know what to do and how to prevent any accidents for happening, but basically you need to jump into the muddy waters during the day. These are usually lagoons, and you need to approach the coast because that's where crocodiles usually are basking, and then they go into the water. And we need to surround with a net a big animal, and then someone goes inside with a crocodile and uses a snooze to you know, get the the mouse. And then once he puts it up, we all jump into the crocodile and restrain it. And then we have to weight it and measure it. So it's a high adventure. And also you can't see anything. Sometimes crocodiles escape and they can just, you know, you can feel the tails but the team is extremely experienced and nobody got hurt really ever. And it's just that you have to be very, very careful, very quiet, and you need to follow orders of the main biologist that you know is the most knowledgeable. So you can't just be distracted. So
goodness me,
a lot of fun, but definitely not like with the sea turtles. It was definitely more dangerous.
Yeah. It's a long way from doing a PhD at Columbia University in New York.
A long way indeed, yes.
Yeah. Natalia, I mean, I first of all, I'd like to say I think it's fantastic and just a huge achievement to have the marine protected area. And I really love the way that it's so much about finding solutions and compromises that work for everybody and finding opportunities too. I think it makes me want to go and visit, like jump on a plane right now and go and visit. It just sounds absolutely beautiful. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with? Is there a message, anything we've missed, a message you'd like to leave for people who are listening, anything at all?
Yes, I guess. I mean, if people are interested in joining this field, I would say welcome. This is the decade to work in all sorts of issues. There is more attention, there is more funding, there is more urgency than ever. So don't think that you need to be like a rocket scientist to be able to do conservation. There are many, many angles to it, many, many skills needed, from communication to working with people, to working with the animals, to planning, etc. And then also to think about our planet collectively and to see these areas that we want to protect as a way to support our children and grandchildren and family members and loved ones into the future, to leave them a better place, and also to live together with other species that have as much stake and right to live in this planet as crocodiles and sea turtles and corals. So I'm an optimist in spite of all the challenges that we're facing. I think this is the time to recruit more people, to get passionate about these things, to find solutions, and not to just, you know, get sad about it and feel this despair. I would say join in any capacity and let's think about the future together and respect other living things as much as we try to respect each other. So that would be my message.
Oh, that's a fabulous message. And I love the optimism about the message. Thank you so much, Natalia, for all that you're doing. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much to you. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Brave New Women. Certain podcast sites such as Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Podchaser let you leave a rating and a review. The more ratings and reviews we get, the more people will listen, and the more these women's stories will be shared. So I'd really appreciate it if you could. Thanks for listening.